Hi there, welcome to the Switch Hit Cricket Show here on ESPNcricinfo.com. I'm Jonathan Harris-Bass. Coming up on the show, England-Australia is upon us with five one-day internationals to come. Is this where the Ashes begin? Both teams have seen off their pre-series opposition with varying ease. We take a look at the players we expect to stand out in the coming weeks. Elsewhere, India and Sri Lanka will contest the Asia Cup final after remaining unbeaten against Bangladesh and Pakistan, and the T20 Cup's nearly at its halfway point with parity reigning supreme in both the North and the South leagues. So for that and much more from the world of cricket, stay tuned to the Switch Hit Cricket Show on ESPNcricinfo.com. Joining me in the studio, we have CricInfo UK Editor-in-Chief Andrew Miller, Assistant Editor Bryden Coverdale, and the Daily Mail's Lawrence Booth. And we start with England against Australia, 2010, Part 1. It is the eve of a five-day, one-day international series. And England's preparation for this series, of course, was a victory against Scotland, Andrew. We saw Mike Yardie and Ajmal Shahzad both bowl well, and also Andrew Strauss and Craig Kiesewetter looking in decent form with the bat. All round, a comfortable victory, not really proving very much.
No, except that they can beat teams with ease, which is something you haven't often been able to say about England. I mean, I remember the last time they played a nation of that ilk, Ireland, in a match at the end of last summer. They came so close to losing it. It was a bit of a sticky dog of a pitch and strange scenario because it was only a day after the Oval victory in the Ashes, of course. But, you know, England really laboured back then. Here it was clinical. You know, they won with 16 overs to spare or something of the sort. And they just looked like a team with form in this format and focus ahead of what is actually quite a significant one-day series, and that's not something you can say very often.
We saw Jimmy Anderson, Lawrence, back with the ball in hand, leading the attack. We mentioned him on last week's show, that uncharacteristic outburst about being left out of the starting lineup in the T20 World Cup, and then unsure whether he was going to be given the opportunity to lead the attack when it came to one-day international cricket. How impressed were you by his performance?
Well, I mean, 2 for 40-odd doesn't necessarily settle the argument one way or the other. In fact, Shahzad ended up with better figures, picked up a couple of wickets at the end. And he may be a sort of more useful bowler in this series. We saw how, in his second spell at Old Trafford in the Test match, he got it to reverse a bit. He was slightly innocuous in the first spell. If he comes on later, it depends how Strauss uses him. If he comes on later with a slightly older ball and gets it to go a bit, that could be interesting, depending on the conditions. Old Trafford, the third game, the pitch sometimes helps reverse swing. So, yeah, Jimmy, it's going to be a big series for Jimmy. He said last week that he felt he'd slipped down the pecking order, didn't quite know where his position was. So he really needs a couple of twofers and threefers and keeping it tight, especially because he's never done well in Australia before, average 84, I think, in the last Ashes series. Do they rate him in Australian conditions? This is his chance to score a couple of psychological points.
Andrew just mentioned there, Bryden, the fact that England used to have trouble sometimes putting away easier opposition, which they didn't against Scotland. Australia actually laboured to victory against Ireland themselves just a few days ago. Now, it's a bit of a makeshift Australian squad, but they've had two rather unconvincing victories so far, against Ireland and then against Middlesex. What have you made of their performances since you've landed to follow this tour?
A few of the guys hadn't had much cricket behind them, I suppose. Since the World 2020, some of the guys have been having a bit of a rest. But it probably was quite important that James Hopes, who hadn't played in the World 2020, got five wickets against Ireland. He's starting to find some form. Tim Payne, who went on that World 2020 trip but didn't play, he made some good runs against Ireland. So there are some decent signs there, even though the results haven't quite been as convincing as they might have liked.
Certainly injuries affecting the Australians in the lead-up to this tour, which has made it a bit of a makeshift squad, which Tim Neilson, the coach, is pleased about in many ways because it gives opportunities to players who otherwise might not have had them.
Oh, look, we're hoping that these young players who come in, we've got the likes of Haddon and Johnson who are missing at the moment with injury. We're hoping this gives great opportunity to a couple of young blokes. We've got Josh Hazlewood, who's a tall, young 19, 20-year-old fast bowler. We've got Tim Payne, who's back, who debuted over here and played really well last year. So we've got quite a good mix, as well as the likes of Ponting and Clark, and Doug Bollinger's never bowled here. Our bowling attack is quite inexperienced, actually, in England, in the fact that in last year's one days when we played, none of these bowlers were here. So with Bollinger, Harris, McKay, Hazelwood as our fast bowling attack, it's a completely new attack. So it's a great opportunity for them and a great experience. We've been working hard over the last couple of years since we've had some retirements, and we've had some more since then, to try and create, I suppose, some real depth in our squad. Knowing that we were playing so much, there was likely to become a time where there were some fast bowlers especially who got hurt or needed a rest. And to have four brand new guys here, and most of them have already had some impact in international cricket, it's really exciting for us, so we're looking forward to them doing well.
Well, they have won their two matches, as I've already mentioned, but a man who managed to score runs against them and then was pretty dismissive is a man no longer in the England frame, Awais Shah, who scored 92. And his comments after that match against Middlesex were fairly derogatory.
It was interesting, wasn't it? It was, you know, saying they've got no X factor. It reminded me a bit of Steve Harmison. He had a bit of a pop at the Aussies last summer. Obviously, Harmison at that stage was nowhere near selection, but he was a significant enough name to be able to chirp away and people would pick up on it. And it's almost that same scenario coming up again. Shah is unlikely to feature, but the Aussies will remember him as someone who's been around. And, you know, to have a significant player saying that, yeah, we don't actually rate you very much, it'll get their hackles up, and we'll see what happens.
I tell you, it reminded me of, I remember Mike Atherton once saying that the only time he'd ever heard Graham Hicks sledge anyone was when he came on as a substitute fielder against Sri Lanka. So he knew he didn't have to bat. It's a bit like Shah. He knows he's not going to get a game in this series, so he can chirp away from the sidelines. I wonder how delighted the actual England squad are by that comment, the X-factor comment, because they're hardly going to need motivating.
They're certainly not going to need motivating, although they don't have the same motivation as they did last year when, of course, they won by 6-1 in what seemed like a rather defunct one-day international series as far as the English were concerned. I'm sure not as far as the Australians were concerned. Pretty hard to see a repeat of that this time out, wouldn't you say, Bryden?
It wouldn't surprise me if it's a 5-0 or 4-1 series this time, but there's a lot of individuals in the Australian team who are going to be pretty keen to push their place in the side because they're not quite established yet, and one of those is probably the one player who does have X factor in the team, which is Stephen Smith, the young leg-spinning all-rounder, a very, very useful sort of number 7 or 8 batsman. Problem is he may not be in the starting lineup for the first match or two, but there will be some individuals there keen to establish themselves.
We heard there from Tim Nielsen a few moments ago the fact that Doug Bollinger leading the attack is relatively inexperienced when it comes to English conditions. He's of course become an integral part in the Australian attack, and he bowled very economically against Middlesex as well. So I mean, it looks to me as though the backbone's there, although this talk of X factor may not be. I'm sure you expect the Australians to equip themselves very well over here.
Yeah, and it will be interesting to see how that attack under Bollinger's leadership performs. I mean, he's a very aggressive type of bowler who he might go for a few runs, but he should take a few wickets as well. Ryan Harris, who's sort of his second fast bowler in the team, I suppose, he's performed pretty well in his first year or so of international cricket. So there's certainly potential there, but I guess it's a matter of how they go on a big tour in England under the spotlight.
It's an interesting time, of course, because it comes just a few months before England travel to Australia for the Ashes. But more important, it's also a very important series as far as 50-over cricket's concerned. Now, we had lots of talk on last week's show again about 50-over cricket, split innings cricket, and talking to Mr. Lorgat about all of these issues. Andrew, you've said in your preview to this series that it potentially is a very big 50-over tournament, this one. It's the sort that we should be turning our attention to. Now, first of all, it's clashing with the Football World Cup, which potentially could affect attendance and people's interest in this competition. But how important, aside from the clashing with another sport, is this for the shorter form of the game, not the shortest, though?
Well, I think it's fascinating. When I saw it being scheduled last summer, my eyes rolled back into my skull, and I thought, oh, God, what are they doing? But, you know, on reflection, it actually makes a lot of sense. Because, as you do mention, the Football World Cup is dominating everything right now. So the only thing that was really going to recapture the attention was a big name series, not so much, you know, you could have had a test series against Pakistan being played right now, but it would have been completely lost. Because it's England, Australia, people will be switched onto it. I mean, even if it's peripheral, as people mourn being knocked out by Slovenia on Wednesday, I mean, it will be something they can get their teeth into, especially if England actually win. And, you know, because it's happening in the build-up to an Ashes series, people will be focused, including guys in the team, more importantly. I mean, we've always had this issue with one-day cricket. England, for some reason, cannot focus on one-day cricket when it happens after the main event, after a test series. When it's a build-up to a test series, as they showed way back in the days of the Texaco Trophy. You know, England were invincible in Texaco Trophy matches precisely because they came at the start of the season and they could get ahead of steam ahead of the test series, and as it happens in the 1990s, they generally lost their test series, but at least they had that incentive going into it. So, yeah, if bilateral ODI series are to survive, they need to be put in context and they need to have enough meaning for people to actually want to watch them. And, you know, something of this ilk being given a grandstand stage to say, okay, come on, show us what you got at the height of our summer. Let's see what they can do.
Certainly doesn't get any bigger for England and Australia than playing against each other, so there is plenty to pay for, and I'm fairly sure that it will capture the imagination of the cricketing fraternity and the cricket-watching public, and I'm sure we'll pick up a few stragglers from England's ejection from the Football World Cup as well. But let's take a look now at the main protagonist for the England team, Lawrence, and who do you expect to stand out in this series?
Well, I've got a sneaking feeling that Strauss is going to score some runs. It was only a year ago he was actually England's best batsman in that 6-1 defeat, sort of kept getting starts, never made a big score, but, well, I say held the team together. He didn't quite do that because he got no support. But he's got a massive point to prove, namely that he should be England's captain at the 50-over World Cup in February, March in the subcontinent. Played very well the other day, outscored Kieswetter briefly at the start of the innings for his 60 against Scotland. And I think he can adapt. We saw Alastair Cook adapting in Bangladesh to 50-over cricket, a guy we said should be nowhere near the team. Strauss has got more shots than Cook. He's a very good back foot player, and that will complement Kieswetter's front foot mode of attack, I think. And he has the Aussies' respect, and I think he's going to be well up for this. I mean, Peterson is an obvious name to pick, but I think Strauss could be a key figure at the top.
It's fascinating, actually, what Strauss managed last year because, yeah, as we do, as Lawrence mentioned, he did top score. But what happened also was he always got out playing his first risky shot. You know, he would be solid, and then suddenly he'd realise that, my God, I'm the only person who's actually middling the ball. I better try and up it. And he'd always get out trying to play that shot. Now, all of a sudden, we've got Peterson back in form, we've got Owen Morgan in the middle order, people who can play off him. So, yeah, if he carries on doing exactly what he's done so far, provides the anchor with the confidence in the team, in his teammates who didn't have last year, yeah, he could well go far.
Well, although Kevin Peterson didn't have a good knock himself up against the Scots at the weekend, he is still another figure that the Australians certainly respect, and their captain, Ricky Ponting, was quick to point out how important Peterson is to England's cause and what a difference he's going to make playing against him, considering that he hasn't been involved in recent contests between the two nations.
Yeah, he played, first two tests last time, missed the whole one-day series, and yeah, I mean, his impact on their side is pretty dramatic, I think. He's the sort of figure that they like having around their group. So, we're going to have to play well against him, as we are against the rest of their players. You know, they've got a bit of a spring in their step at the moment, I think, the English, and we have to make sure that we stamp ourselves on this series right from the start.
Well, the other point that Ricky Ponting making there, of course, Lawrence, is how important this is in relation to the Ashes. And many people started by saying that they thought that this wouldn't necessarily have too much influence on the forthcoming series, of course, because it's a change of continents, a change of countries when they get round to playing the Ashes down in November in Australia. But it is a momentum thing, and we've seen it again and again between these two sides over the last 10 years especially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2005, the 2020 game is always used as an example of England scoring an early points, bowling Australia out for 79 at the Rose Bowl. Now, I know that was part of the Ashes trip, but then before 2006-07, England and Australia met in the Champions Trophy, and Australia absolutely bulldozed England, and you had the sort of suspicion that England's mind was then on the Ashes, but it wasn't on it sufficiently to perform well enough and concentrate in that game, and you thought, at that point, I thought, they're done for, basically. So, yes, this is a different trip, it's a different format, but there are five games here, and if one team wins 4-1 or 5-0, that's going to be a hell of a momentum to take to Brisbane November the 25th, so they're going to both be up for it.
Both teams definitely up for it, but Bryden, do you feel a little nervous, perhaps, of the fact that this Australian team isn't the first-choice team and therefore might come under increased pressure, and especially if they lose early in this one-day international series, could be on the back of a hiding themselves?
Well, I guess it's a case of if it's not the first 11, then there's perhaps not a lot to lose, especially for as I was saying before, the individuals who are keen to sort of make themselves a part of the side. But I mean, there's a lot of cricket to come before the Ashes for Australia. They've got two tests against Pakistan here in England, and possibly two tests against India if that series goes ahead. So it's probably the sort of situation where if they win, they can say we'll take the momentum, and if they lose, they can say, well, it probably doesn't mean that much anyway. So I'm not sure how much they will really take into the Gabba.
And Andrew, your views on this, and also what you think the outcome of this series is going to be?
I think it's significant. I really do. I don't think that both the Aussies and the English will doubtless claim it doesn't count for much, except so many of them already talked it up as, yeah, this does matter. I mean, even Ricky Ponting himself, in a separate interview, he said, yeah, everything counts towards November, and we will have no excuses come November. That's basically what he said. So, yeah, everyone's going to be watching this, looking for the little details and who's got the one up on who, and yeah, it matters. And I think England will win this one. I genuinely do. I don't think that will necessarily mean they'll win the Ashes, because of course winning in Australia is one of the toughest things that England have ever managed to do. Three times they've managed it. It's just not something that happens very often. But they will have more belief going into this Ashes tour than I think they've taken into many Ashes tours for an awfully long time, and that really should stem from putting up a very good performance here.
Well, Andrew, then, very confident, perhaps, of England victory. Bryden, if Australia are to win this series, they've certainly got potential with the ball, but with the bat, who are going to be the men that they turn to, other than Cameron White, who seems to be holding together every single innings that they play at the moment?
Well, it's funny, you mentioned sort of being a second 11. It's not a second 11 in terms of the batting. They're without Brad Haddin, and you might argue Callum Ferguson might have been in if he was fit, but realistically, Ricky Ponting and Michael Clarke and Michael Hussey in that middle order are going to be the key men. They're the senior men. Ricky Ponting is not the sort of guy who would want to get let England get on top of him, so I think he'll start with a bang. Michael Clarke's coming off two ducks against Ireland and Middlesex, and having struggled a bit in the World 2020, so he's someone who really does need to step up a bit to justify keeping that spot. And then White and Hussey at 5 and 6. That's a pretty strong batting lineup, and with the bowlers, I think they're good enough that they can still win the series.
What did you make of comments by Ponting about the fact when they played Middlesex that he said that Adam Gilchrist could still probably walk into the side?
Well, he possibly could, but the reality is that Shane Watson and Tim Payne at the top of the order is a pretty good opening combination. Tim Payne is someone who's really stepped up into that second wicket-keeping role over the past year. England have seen him play pretty well last time he was here, and Shane Watson's been just about Australia's best player over the last year or 18 months. So I don't think there's too many chinks in that top order.
So you can see an Australian victory?
I can, yeah. I mean, Australia have won their last five one-day series, plus the Champions Trophy, and several of those were without some key players. Like in India last year, they just had a revolving door of injuries and new players coming in, and they beat India in India. So I think there is the depth there, and I would expect Australia to win, although perhaps 3-2 rather than the whitewash that we almost saw last year.
It was very close to being a whitewash. Lawrence, just a final word. I mean, we've got one of each there. Andrew thinks England are going to win. Bryden thinks Australia are going to win. Are you going to be patriotic or realistic or both?
Well, I'll try to be objective. I don't think there have been too many England-Australia series, any form of cricket, where I've gone into it thinking England are going to win this. I'm not really thinking that now, but I'd take 3-2 to England just because they're on a roll. They're looking to take that 20-20 mentality into 50-over cricket. The Australian attack is unproven in these conditions, and I just fancy that there's a mood about this England team, and 3-2.
Well, we will wait and see. Of course, everything kicks off with the first match at the Rose Bowl, and then there are games at the Swalick Arena and Old Trafford before we reconvene on the Switch Hit Cricket Show next Tuesday. Well, elsewhere in the world of cricket, the Asia Cup's moved a step closer to its conclusion. The final's already decided. Sri Lanka-India, the match that will decide the tournament winners. They're both unbeaten, face each other on the 22nd of June in a final group game before the final itself on the 24th of June. Now, they had a dramatic win against Pakistan, Lawrence, and India are looking pretty good, but would you fancy them above Sri Lanka, or is it pretty even going into this final?
Well, it's probably pretty even, but India, Harbhajan Singh hit a six off the penultimate ball against Pakistan, almost erasing memories, but not quite, of Javed Miandad's last ball six at Sharjah in 1986, which of course was a very traumatic moment in Indian cricket history. Well, this is some sort of revenge, and that may just steal them for this game. They were dismal in Zimbabwe, the tri-series recently. They lost twice to Zimbabwe, admittedly with a weakened team. So they've got it's the cliched point to prove. They have now got it, and that's their chance to prove to their country that they aren't just their equivalent of England's footballers, over-pampered, overpaid, and don't really care. So big moment for them, and I think they might just pull out the stops.
They'll have to do it without Virender Sehwag, who's out with a hamstring injury, and will miss both of those games. Pakistan themselves, though, bounced back pretty well. Outstanding performance from Shahid Afridi. He scored 124 off 60 balls as Pakistan posted a record one-day international score against Bangladesh. 385 for 7 they amassed in the end, which is just a phenomenal total from the team and an extraordinary innings from Afridi.
Well, it's incredible, isn't it? I mean, it harks back to his early days. I mean, was it his 38-ball century and when he was a 17-year-old against Sri Lanka? We're talking, it's 13 years ago now, isn't it? And he still does it. I mean, you know exactly, I've not seen the innings, but you know exactly how it went, really. Just boom, boom, have a go if you think you're hard enough. And generally he is. And yeah, I love him. I think he's one of the greatest sloggers I've ever seen in my life. Long may he reign.
Despite that monstrous innings, we still didn't get anyone overtaking the worst figures in one-day international cricket history. So got pretty close, but those are still securely with our Australian friend, who I always forget his
Mick
name.
Mick Lewis.
Thank you very much for reminding me. There we go. Mick Lewis. He likes to be reminded, apparently, about those stats as well. In the West Indies and St Kitts, South Africa up against the West Indies in the second test, and that's rather descended into farce. It's a pitch that's rather reminiscent of the majority of pitches we saw over there during England's tour last year. Three centurions for the South Africans as they amassed 543 for six. And the West Indies' reply has been equally impressive, if you want to call it that. 151 not out from Shivraj Chanderpaul and 114 from Brendan Nash. They're currently 424 for four. So 10 wickets down, nearly 1,000 runs scored 3 days in. It's rather depressing.
Well, it is. I mean, particularly at this particular juncture in the sporting calendar when nobody gives a hoot about Test cricket, it's quite depressing to have to witness that, particularly South Africa, of course. I mean, who in South Africa is actually going to be watching that? It's also a case of pretty poor venue to choose for a test match, to be honest. I mean, St Kitts was great for the Women's World Cup because it has the shortest boundaries in the world, so, you know, it gives value for the likes of Deandra Dottin, who wants to slot it over the top for 30 ball hundreds or whatever she managed. But, you know, for international men's Test cricket, you know, having a pitch where how many sixes were there in the first innings, 18 or something, it's just it's not good enough to have Test cricket played on pitches where you can just tap the ball over square leg for six each ball.
Do you think it's playing out to a draw by any chance?
Even West Indies shouldn't mess this one. I mean, Brendan Nash, one of the centurions, he was the guy who said recently that the West Indies were sick of losing, so they may regard bore draws as actually good for, I mean, remember Nasser Hussain in England said you had to make them harder to beat first before they started winning. West Indies haven't really gone through the process yet of being harder to beat, despite beating England last year in a slightly freakish series. So they'll probably take a couple of bore draws against strong test teams against South Africa.
Well, one could say that there is the possibility that the Friends Provident T20 is turning not into a bore draw, just perhaps bore, one could say. We're not even halfway through it yet. But there was some good news for Surrey, as Andrew Symonds managed to guide them to victory, albeit on the Duckworth-Lewis method against Kent. But just taking a look at the two tables, other than Notts and Sussex and Somerset, all of the other sides involved at the moment are pretty much on exactly the same 50-50 ratio of win-loss so far. And so it's very hard to know who's going to be involved in the shake-up come the conclusion of this tournament. As we say, still not even halfway through it.
Yeah, 71 gone, 80 to go. It's, you know, in days gone by, that would be quite enough, thank you. We'd be getting ready for the final and, you know, you'd have your two outstanding sides rightly into the final. But right at this moment, it's, you know, take your pick. It's not a good advert, and we've been saying this, you know, in the build up. It's not wisdom after the event. It's just not an enticing format, and it's not a lot they can do about it now. They've made their bed. They've got to lie in it. But I'd like to fast forward another 3 weeks and get to the nitty gritty of it, because there's not a lot that you really want to get your teeth into right now.
I mean, let's face it, we'll probably be here in a week's time discussing exactly the same, and still 55 matches to go.
I mean, the Fox made an appearance at the Oval the other day. I mean, that was a nice picture for the papers, but of course none of the papers used them because they were too busy getting pictures of Wayne Rooney in a strop. So never mind. One day they'll get their act together and have a tournament that people will actually think, yeah, let's get involved in this. This works.
I remember the IPL, wasn't there a moment where we looked at the league table and the team at the top were doing very well and the team at the bottom weren't, and the other six all had sort of played 10, won 5, lost 5. And we suggested then that perhaps this said something about the lottery nature of 2020 cricket, and this theory isn't being knocked down by what's going on at the moment in the county game. I remember Trescothick, I think it was the start of the season, or the start of this competition, I think Somerset lost one of their early games and said, oh, well, there's 15 more to go. And your kind of heart sunk the moment you heard that. People have always complained about the county championship, that you can have a bad game and think to yourself, well, there's still another 14, 15 games left. Well, the same now appears to apply to 2020. And if that breeds quality, then I'm a Dutchman.
Well, the irony I find is that we've just seen the World 2020, where the single best team in the tournament, i.e. England, went on to win it because, you know, it was short enough to really bring out the focus that was required for the cream to rise to the top. Right now, you know, drifting. I mean, you may be able to look back on that table in 3 weeks' time and think, oh yeah, there is a bit of a pattern there, that Sussex were actually as good as their numbers suggest they might be at this moment, but nobody can tell yet. It really isn't inspiring.
Well, it will continue to go on for at least another week, and when we reconvene, we'll be able to discuss it at more length. That's all we've got time for on the show this week, though. Thank you very much to Bryden, to Andrew and to Lawrence. Join us on Tuesday next week as we review the first 3 one-day internationals between England and Australia and catch up with all the other top stories in the world of cricket. Till then, though, I've been Jonathan Harris-Bass. You've been listening to the Switch Hit Cricket Show on ESPNcricinfo.com.